Hello and welcome to Monocle 24's The Urbanist, the show all about the cities we live in. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up on this week's programme...
What are some of those new partnerships that are going to emerge, and how are we going to see boroughs do it differently and hopefully get the numbers up too?
And hopefully Crossrail will open.
We look at the topics that have dominated urban debate in 2018, from failed rail projects to housing battles. And we also look ahead to a few dreams for 2019. That's all coming up right here on The Urbanist with me, Andrew Tuck. So welcome to this week's programme. My guests today are Kat Hannah, who's the Associate Director of Urban Change at Cushman & Wakefield, and Christian Woolmar, the writer and broadcaster specialising in transport. And his latest title is Driverless Cars on a Road to Nowhere. Welcome both to The Urbanist End of Year Special. Now, Christian, we're going to start with one of those rare things where you and me had a bit of a moment in the summer. I don't know if you remember, because you wrote a very nice piece championing the opening of Crossrail, and it includes in here the very nice sentence, "We're going to have to wait to December to see the entirety of it fully functioning. We're in December. None of it is functioning." What the hell went wrong, Walmart?
They had promised me that, you know, it was on budget, on time. I had begun to get my suspicions by the time I wrote that, but officially it was still on schedule. I think that fundamentally what has gone wrong is the sheer scale of the task. They're building a 42-kilometre tunnel underneath London, which is all completed, so a twin-track railway which basically links East and West London between Paddington and Liverpool Street and then spins off southwards via Canary Wharf to the other side of the river. And it includes 10 below-the-surface stations. I don't call them underground stations because they are nothing like the underground stations we know today. They are on a completely different scale. They are absolutely massive. They are incredibly complex. They're built to the highest modern standards. And I think they just bit off more than they could chew. There's really no kind of, I don't think, great scandal or whatever. What is worrying is that, first of all, they announced a delay until autumn 2019. But then, more ominously, just a couple of weeks ago, they then said, well, we're not quite sure we'll manage to stick to that, and we've got no opening date. Now, that is concerning because it does cost a lot of money to keep the project running every day. And, of course, they're not getting revenue in every day. So the finances of Transport for London are getting worse. The mayor is getting redder and redder in the face, both with anger and embarrassment. And London is not getting this amazing new railway. Now, it will be forgotten about. Honestly, you know, the British Museum was late. The Jubilee Line extension was late. The Channel Tunnel was late. The Channel Tunnel rail link was late, you know, and over budget. This is what happens with mega projects.
You don't think it's a Berlin airport kind of late, years later?
No, I've written that. The Berlin airport and Stuttgart, their underground new station outside the station and stuff, those are on a different scale. So the Germans are better at this than us.
Kat, are you concerned that we do seem to have a very difficult task when it comes to, one, working out how things are going to cost, how much it's going to cost. So in Christian's article, I think we gave the price tag of 15 billion. I believe another couple of billion are going to be chucked at it roughly to kind of keep it on track, as it were. But why is it so difficult to predict how long things are going to take, when they're actually going to be up and running, and what they're going to cost?
I mean, I just share, firstly, actually, a degree of optimism, I think, with Christian. You know, this is going to happen. This is going to go ahead. You know, hopefully you can bring us back next year and we'll hopefully be on the cusp of the thing opening. I mean, in terms of why costs have escalated, I know one of the challenges in particular has been actually remarkably less actually around the hardware and the excavations and the engineering required for the stations and the tunnelling, but actually around some of the software and signalling and some of these questions around things like interoperability between your various signalling systems. You'd like to think that that would be the kind of stuff that could be anticipated. I'm sure there will be questions as to perhaps why that wasn't anticipated. But I think part of this, you know, a city like London, there is as much going on underground as there is above ground. And I imagine, you know, I'm no expert on engineering, but actually it's once you really start developing some of these stations, you will start finding things that are potentially quite a bit more complex than you initially thought. And I think, again, echoing what Christian said, let's not kind of underestimate actually the scale of some of these station projects, because we're also talking about retail, about offices around them, about the impact that they're going to have on the surrounding street in the public realm. So I think there has been an ambition with Crossrail for it not just to be an engineering project, or just being about tunnelling, but actually something that's got a profound impact on how people experience London in terms of how they move around. Potentially, yes, maybe they've been a bit ambitious with some of that. But I'd also think, you know, we tend to be quite self-effacing and British about this. Oh, the Germans do it better. We're just terrible about it. And I think it was actually a story I looked at for you at some point in the year with a review of kind of these big mega projects that happened. Actually, the UK is not that bad. And actually, you know, overspend tends to happen on nearly every single project. But actually, you know, our performance is really not that bad. So I do think, you know, perhaps there is this slight caricature that we always tend to overrun, that we always tend to overspend. I'm not saying that's not true, but I think it's something that is generally characteristic of projects of this scale and complexity rather than something that's sort of innately wrong with how we're delivering.
Can I add something to that? I mean, yes, the overrun, even if it is 2 billion, will only be about 12, 15%, you know, which on the scale of things is not enormous. Let me just put in an example of the complexity of this, right? So they obviously, they had to order trains, right? And they had various bidders for the trains, and they end up ordering a train that was slightly longer, but also slightly lighter, right, from Bombardier, and didn't quite fill in the envelope of the tunnel in the same way as the train that was expected. In other words, there was more of a gap between the top of the tunnel and surrounding the tunnel and the train than expected. Now, because of that, they then had to re-engineer the fans that are keeping the ventilation going in the stations. And why is that? It's because the train itself was expected to largely, you know, through the piston effect, create the ventilation. But it wouldn't do that because they ordered a slightly lighter train, which is cheaper on rail maintenance, but resulted in an extra expense on the fan. So that sort of complexity is exactly what you're talking about there, about the complication between the different systems, all these systems, all the different electrical systems, the ventilation systems, the ticketing system, the, you know, a PA and so on.
Just tell me, what's interesting is, you know, that the head of Crossrail has had to resign. He had a very brief tenure, a matter of months, as the head of the high-speed rail project as well. I think he'd barely found his desk before he realised he was going to have to give up both jobs. But does it, when you have like a problem like this, it seems to me that the difficulty is that it changes the discussion about the next project. So now people are saying that high-speed rail will never come in on time. It's never going to come in anywhere near the numbers we're being given. We shouldn't do it because we should be sceptical about the numbers we're given. Is that one of the risks of this, that, you know, it does have a knock-on on other grand projets?
Oh, absolutely. And the other grand projet might well sound the death knell for is Crossrail 2, which is bigger than Crossrail 1, estimated at 27 billion, maybe 30 billion, something like that. And it goes in a sort of northeast, a southwest direction, much needed if we're going to develop some of the housing areas, which at the moment are very badly served by transport and therefore are underdeveloped. But I can't see it getting the go-ahead anytime soon in relation to this.
Now, a couple of months ago, we had a launch here for the book that we've done about building better cities. And you were on a panel here, Kat. And there was one little kind of, well, there were a few nice sparky moments. There was certainly one which arose around housing and how, you know, the audience and us look at the privilege of the kind of access we have to housing when we rarely step away to think about the city in its entirety. And this isn't just a London story. This is a story that you could be telling in New York, in Barcelona, in Milan, in any city. There's a feeling that the housing market has conspired in recent years against the people who live in the city. It's become for an investor class. There's a feeling that the way that houses and properties are put up for Airbnb has stripped neighbourhoods of their capacity to take in long-term renters who are from the community, for example. When you look back on the year, you know, we've had, with Brexit, a hint of a slowdown in some of the property excesses here in London. But do you see the beginning of a discussion about something needs to change and actually something changing too?
To be brutally honest, I think the discussion's been going on for quite a while now. I've certainly been in the kind of policy world for a whole 5 years, and it's something that I pretty much, my first ever project was looking again at this challenge of how do we cater for what's often called the intermediate market, so people that wouldn't be eligible for social housing but can't afford to get on the housing ladder at full market rate. You know, this is a problem. It's not a new problem. Is it getting worse? You know, in certain cities, yes. And that's often, it's not just actually about house prices, but also what's happening to things like income and wages in relation to those house prices as well. So you threw forward kind of quite a few examples of, you know, all these dynamics are at play. to be slightly wonkish about it, I do think actually one of the more optimistic moments of last year, we did have in the budget an agreement to actually lift the cap on public sector borrowing for housing, which essentially, you know, is something, again, that's been called for years, but it would enable local councils to do more to provide housing. We've already seen a lot of London boroughs actually, even before that, really get going in terms of delivering either themselves or in joint ventures with private sector partners. I'd like to think that, you know, now that announcement has been made, that is going to have some impact on numbers because, you know, let's be honest, of course the private sector has a role. Are they going to solve the housing crisis? No, not on their own, they're not. So it is, again, it's about seeing these new types of partnerships coming forward.
Yes, I've been around this for longer. I worked for Shelter in the 1980s. That's because I'm very old. And, you know, these issues were around, but it was just on the cusp of this disaster being created because the right to buy legislation was passed in 1980 by Mrs. Thatcher's newly elected Conservative government. And that kind of changed the game utterly. And then we had a whole period where basically local authorities were not allowed to build housing or were certainly discouraged from doing so, where the money, the receipts from council house sales were essentially purloined by the Treasury rather than the councils allowed to build. And do you know what? I mean, ultimately, the solution is very simple. You know, we actually have to shift the dividing line between the people who can afford to buy and the middle, right? So we have to cater for that middle through social housing. So we have to shift what social housing is aimed at. Now, it might not be 100% social housing. It might be, you know, some of these shared equity ideas. But we have to get away from the idea that the only solution is to get people to buy their own homes. And their last announcement by the government did seem to at least recognise this. And of course, the ownership mode has actually reduced in recent years. And so the idea of the property-owning democracy of Mrs. Thatcher is long gone. And we have to encourage local authorities to build and build good housing. It actually doesn't need much subsidy. I mean, the solutions are all there. There's no rocket science. You just have to accept that, yes, you need a bit of subsidy to kickstart some social housing and boom. In London, it's more difficult because of the land prices, but there's nothing kind of amazing about it. We know the solutions. They were the same as they were when I worked for Shelter 30 years ago.
Kat.
I just wanted to come into that point about change of tenure as well. And I will often say this, you know, I'm a millennial. I rent along with a lot of people in kind of my age cohort, not just in London, but across cities. Again, it's sometimes slightly frustrating to say, actually, look, what we need is people to realise that ownership actually shouldn't be the be-all and end-all. And, you know, actually, it's good that we've seen this shift away just from a reliance on home ownership. Yes, that diversification is welcome, but it's actually, well, what's the quality and what's the experience for a lot of people renting? You know, I've personally generally been very lucky. I know a lot of people who haven't been, or people who have children and who are dealing with often short-term contracts. So, yes, I would very much welcome that diversification of tenure, but the quality and the security needs to be better with that. So I think, you know, and again, I am optimistic. TfL are actually looking at developing some built-to-rent properties. We are seeing this shift towards, you know, the kind of professionalisation of renting. You know, I am optimistic that it can be done. But I think, you know, let's not just say, oh, renting's just much better because we should give up on home ownership. Because it's often, I'll be honest, people of one generation or one class telling people of another class that actually they should just really give up on the idea of owning altogether and settle for renting. And that can sometimes be a little bit frustrating.
I must hold my hand up. I, you know, yes, I am a different generation from you and I do own my own house and I've benefited from all the post-war housing boom twice. You know, I've even been through a couple of divorces, had to start again and managed to kind of build up enough capital to buy a house again. And of course, I couldn't do that now. The private rental sector not only needs better conditions and security of tenure, but of course, along with security of tenure, you have to have rent control. And we shouldn't shy away from that. And don't give me this argument that, oh, people will leave the market. There'll be no kind of rented housing if we have rent control. Because then actually the house prices will go down because people won't want to hold on to this. I mean, the whole idea of buy to let was a shift from one generation to another, I'm afraid. I mean, it was the whole idea was that my generation can let out extra houses and your generation has to pay them through rent and you'll never get to own them. I mean, it is a kind of shocking concept.
But again, there is a challenge there, though, because actually for a lot of people, again, that house that they do let out, that's their pension, actually. So again, there are challenges here around, you know, if suddenly that is impacted, if it does happen too quickly, you know, there are people, you know, that's primarily their main source of income.
Well, they can sell it. They can then sell it and live off the interest on the capital. That's, again, another issue. Why should capital invested in housing earn so much more than anything else? So hopefully it would earn more by being more productive.
Well, let's jump to the next topic, because it still covers the world of rent in many ways. But what's interesting is the high street here in the UK and in many cities around the world. Now, in the summer, we did a special fashion newspaper, which included a big report from New York, where actually many of the issues there are the same as here. So we did a story which looked at the fact that even in areas you think of being popular with, you know, visitors and locals, such as the southern part of Broadway, huge numbers of empty stores. A great little street called Bleecker Street became bleaker in a different way because half the stores were suddenly shuttered up. And what we found there when we did that story was actually one of the problems was that landlords were refusing to come down on the rents that they were demanding. They'd rather see a store remain empty until they could potentially get someone back in, because they had bank loans, for example, pegged to the guarantee of what they would charge as rent. They had investors that would be angry with them if they saw them cutting their rates and would be seen as a company going in the wrong way. That's the same here. We have a failure for landlord and tenant to come to a new understanding about what's happening on the high street. Many department stores here in the UK have suffered in the past year, shuttered, closed down. Kat, what's your feeling about High Street 2.0, or is it 3.0? Maybe these days it's more zeros along than that. But what's the future for the high street here, the UK, anywhere around the world that you've been?
I'm always slightly sceptical of the kind of the high street is dead, retail is dead narrative, because I think it's more of a case of, you know, bad retail won't survive. You know, I think it's unfair to sort of point at certain department stores. You know, you saw all the time these various vox pops with people saying, oh, I can't believe this department store's closed down. It's been the sort of the stalwart of our high street for so long. And the interviewer said, well, when did you last go there? And said, oh, I haven't been for the past 5 years. And there is this extent, you know, if you do not use it, you will lose it. And so it's saying, well, actually, how can we be supporting retailers where they can to improve that offer? And where they're not going to, you know, what are other functions that high street can play? And I think one thing is it's actually thinking about a high street isn't just about retail. It's so many other social functions beyond that. But it's also that retail isn't necessarily just about shopping or what happens in a till. That's just one aspect of the entire shopping process. And yes, a shop can play a role for that. But actually what we're seeing now is the idea of shops as show spaces, again, as social spaces. Look at the popularity of street food markets. You know, the idea that people aren't going out and spending money and spending time with each other and having these kind of meaningful experiences because they want to do everything online, it's a slightly crass narrative. But what it does mean is actually, if I can do things online because they're convenient, I then want to go and out and have an experience that is a bit different, or where I can shop locally, or where I can do something that, again, just speaks to me a bit more personally and that is really more social.
And I think that's interesting here in London. When I was looking at the numbers for some of the bigger department stores here in London, and Selfridges posted a double-digit growth in sales again last year. But when you walk past the front of that store, they say, come in and see, we've got a band on, we've got book readings, they've got so many things happening in that store. They've gone back to the old notion of the department store, almost like a circus. There's so much going on. Christian, do you think that the high street does have a future if it just readjusts and ups its game and makes things, in that awful word, more experiential?
Yes and no. I'm not quite as optimistic as Kat, because I do see there's a lot of types of stores that are going to close. I mean, you know, we've seen the troubled House of Fraser and Debenhams, all these big department stores, local department stores have closed and so on, the Toys R Us. And I mean, you know, the list is very long. And I think you're right in that it's about adaptability. I think it's Stockton-on-Tees, which is in the northeast, which has decided to actually make a real thing of its high street and encourage independence. The council has been very strongly involved in kind of making the urban environment better. Let me add that I think pedestrianisation, something that I'm, you know, very keen on, is my wearing my transport hat, allowing people to cycle into places, you know, not thinking that you just need to provide car parking. But if you encourage people to cycle generally, they will then spend more money in local shops. So that it's all about changing the whole urban kind of planning system in order to encourage. I think where places go wrong is they all think that they have to have their Marks and Spencers and their Waitrose and their absolute standard major stores, and without those, they're doomed. Whereas actually, it's probably quite the opposite. They need those local independents, the little bookshop, the person who repairs shoes, for Christ's sake. You know, those sort of things that you can't do online.
There's lots of things that would be great to talk about, because I know that, again, we champion the notion of the independent store owner, because they're an owner-manager tends to kind of be more embedded in the community and understand what people need. But we're going to have to return to that another time, because we want to jump on to city governance. A simple question. Let's start with you, Kat Hannah. Sadiq Khan, the Mayor of London, good or bad?
On the whole, I'm going to say good. Personally, and I do say this personally, I think I was perhaps very optimistic when Sadiq came in. And then obviously things like Brexit happened immediately after. And I think we've got this far. We haven't even really mentioned Brexit yet.
Let's not.
I know. I won't take it down that way. But, you know, I think that has attracted a fair amount of attention. So I think on the whole, positive. I think next year is going to be interesting to watch. Obviously, 2020 is the next mayoral election. There's going to be a big push, I think, again, particularly on housing numbers. You know, it's one area where mayors tend to get a lot of scrutiny, is various different ways of cutting the statistics about what's in the pipeline and what's been delivered and affordability.
Well, just on that, because I saw that, you know, he obviously had huge numbers that he was going to deliver on affordable housing. First of all, it's difficult always for, you know, the public to understand what is affordable housing. It depends who you are and where you sit in the market. But the numbers have got nowhere near the targets he even set himself. And again, the last time they came out, the Conservatives on the council did accuse him of kind of like somehow pushing the numbers up a little bit at the last minute.
Yeah, I mean, I think as long as we've had the GLA, there has tend to be these reports coming out and a lot of quabbling about those exact statistics. I mean, what I would say is actually, if we look at where Sadiq and his team have taken more immediate action, we have seen, for example, a lot of decisions called in. So what that generally means is often where a local authority has said, no, we maybe think this is too tall, it's going to be too much of an impact on traffic or local services, or various reasons they don't want a plan to go ahead. The mayor, with certain decisions where they're of strategic importance, can say, look, actually, I'm taking this matter out of borough hands and I'm going to make the decision on that. If you look at his track record, firstly, he has intervened quite a lot. And secondly, he has granted approval, often off on the condition of more affordable housing. But particularly in outer London, you know, London has a very peculiar system. You know, the mayor does not make the majority of planning decisions. It is the boroughs. So there is this tension. And I think we're going to see it again happen between, you know, I think Sadiq versus often the suburbs, where there is often a lot of a pushback around new development. So I think, you know, we've seen him, again, like I said, call in quite a lot of these decisions. So, yes, I think you can challenge around the actual numbers, but in terms of where he has been willing to make a judgment call around big emphasis on what's good growth, of good density, high volumes of housing, for example, around public transport, generally doing what in urban terms I think we'd all agree are kind of the sensible things that you should be doing.
Christian, for you, the same question. And would your verdict be based around transport or?
I think other factors as well, housing, policing, planning. Let's get policing out of the way quickly. I mean, there is a big increase in knife crime and he's facing criticism over that. But there's been huge cuts to the policing budget and that is out with his responsibility. So it shows, just as Kat said, that our mayor isn't the mayor of New York in London. You know, he doesn't have those kind of powers, which I think is largely a shame. I think on transport, he's been slightly timid, that he hasn't quite kind of dared to push things forward, for example, on cycling as fast as people would like. But then, you know, there has been a transformation in relation to cycling. It's a shame that he hasn't kind of pushed it further. I think that overall on housing, he's been up against it because there is a silly numbers game. I think that the numbers game is daft. I think if you are building housing that is just going to affluent people buying stuff from abroad as an investment, it is of no use to Londoners. Yes, it's had a few East European builders working on it. And yes, there's a little bit of capital inflow and stuff. but it doesn't do us any good. And in fact, it does us a lot of damage. And so I think if you count a new development in Chelsea with 20 stories and something like 100 flats and say, oh, this is great. It's not. It's absolutely irrelevant to our needs. And Sadiq has stopped quite a lot of that. And so the numbers look much worse than actually they deserve. Boris waved through all sorts of schemes which are now coming to fruition and which are damaging our city, kind of the feel of the city.
And when you look at other cities around the world, is there anywhere over the past year you've been struck by them doing a particularly good job?
I must say, oddly enough, it's because I went to the Monaco conference in Zurich and actually spent quite a lot of time either jogging around the city, taking trams around the city or swimming in the lake. And it's difficult to think of a more pleasant city to live in. And, you know, that has a fantastic network of public transport. Oddly enough, Monaco sent a car to me to the airport, and it was the last thing I wanted. We sat in a traffic jam for half an hour when all I wanted to do was hop on the tram, which would have got me into the hotel in 10 minutes. And that's the sort of example. And similarly, there's lots of French cities which have invested a lot in their tram networks. Spain is now saying that they're going to pedestrianise 100 city centres. So there's a lot of places where the mayors and the city authorities understand that in the medium to long term, there's only one way of improving city centres, and that's to tame the car and attract investment into all sorts of things as a result of that.
And Kat, for you, are there places that have caught your attention this year? Or
sadly, I think my invite to Zurich must have gone lost in the post, but I'll have to check my junk mail folder for that one. But subtle hint for next year. I mean, I was very lucky. I was actually in Seattle and New York just in November, and first time I've been in either of those cities. And as someone who, you know, I spend quite a lot of my time kind of thinking about particularly the centre of cities and how well they function, I think it does make you realise we have spent, you know, especially the first half of this show, critiquing to an extent transport in London. Actually, we're incredibly lucky in terms of what we've got compared particularly to a lot of US cities as well. And again, whilst the narratives around, you know, London only being a city for the rich or for, you know, this idea of pushing people out of the city, actually, our downtowns are pretty great in terms of how active they feel, how lively they are, and the real mix of people that we have there. And I think it gave me a certain, I think, appreciation for London of actually that there is something that's there. I love New York, was blown away by it. The High Line was actually one of those things that actually exceeded my expectations. I thought it was going to be overhyped, and I thought that was great. So again, some of those really interesting initiatives, you know, of actually when this blurring of kind of public realm and infrastructure. And I think that's something that actually we're seeing, I think, cities that are going to do more and more again, especially, as you said, if it's about reducing car use, it's saying, well, what else can we put in to get people moving around the city?
Hopes and dreams for next year, not only in your personal life, this is, but in the world of... urbanism, transport.
Well, I think the biggest shame, to be parochial, to return to London, is that it is proving very difficult for the mayor to pedestrianise Oxford Street. And if there is one scheme that actually is important in world terms, actually, because Oxford Street is our most famous retail street and famous across the world. And the fact that there's a battle over pedestrianising in 2018-19 is completely ridiculous. And the fact that, you know, we can't understand in London that that is the way to improve the urban realm is a sad indication that we're so hooked on old ideas. And Kat talks about New York. New York has done lots of innovative things like pedestrianising Times Square and stuff. And we need that sort of thinking.
And for you, Kat?
I think probably going back to the housing, actually, I'm interested to see the extent to which, you know, the public sector is able to step up in terms of delivery, in terms of design. There have been some great initiatives in terms of, you know, improving and diversifying talent in terms of public sector architecture and design. So I think that's going to be really exciting to watch. But also, what are some of those new partnerships that are going to emerge, and how are we going to see boroughs do it differently and hopefully get the numbers up too?
And hopefully Crossrail will open.
I was going to say, one for me should be that we can potentially do this show from a Crossrail carriage this time next year. I've certainly got an article that was published this summer. I can just change a few facts, I think, and publish again next year, hopefully in the run-up to the big day. Well, Kat Hannah and Christian Wolmar, two great voices here on The Urbanist this year, and two great voices also meeting our listeners as well at events around the world. Thank you for joining us, and see you again in 2019. And that's all for this week's episode of The Urbanist. The show was produced by Carlotta Rabello and was edited by David Stevens. And to play you out of this episode of The Urbanist, here's Malvina Reynolds with Little Boxes. Thank you for listening, city lovers.
Little boxes on the hillside, little boxes made of ticky-tacky, little boxes on the hillside, little boxes all the same. There's a pink one and a green one and a blue one and a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky, and they all look just the same.